Good morning. I appreciate you all letting me the opportunity to speak to you in my dad's absence today. As Daniel mentioned during the Lord's Supper invitation, that this Tuesday, no, is it Thursday? This Thursday, July 4th, will be, if I did the math right, the 253rd anniversary of America gaining independence from British rule, from America becoming its own sovereign country. There's a famous quote from the Revolution, one that we all know, we learned from a very young age. It's a quote from Patrick Henry. He says, "Give me liberty or give me death." It's a quote that resonates with us because of how powerful it is and speaks to how important it was that we gained freedom, that we became independent, that we were free to do as we liked without any restrictions on our civil liberties as well as our God-given human liberties. The patriots, the ones that fought for this country, realized that there was a lot at stake, that oppression was no way to live at all, and that if death is what it took to gain liberty, then so be it. But today I want to talk about a group of people that did not have this mindset, because what they were dealing with was something that was very different. They decided that when it comes to a matter of life or liberty, they chose life over liberty, and they were all the better for it, even if their means of obtaining it was less than desirable or less than moral. And the story I'm talking about is an Old Testament story. And it's one that, though you may have heard before, this I wanted to read it again, and I had some thoughts on it, and I wanted to share them with you, especially in light of Independence Day approaching. And we'll see if perhaps there's another perspective we can look at, and another, some more points, different viewpoints, different mindsets. So these are just some thoughts I had that I'd like to share, and I'd appreciate if you had an open mind this morning and indulged some of these thoughts. So the story we're going to be reading is going to be found in Joshua chapter 9. This is when the children of Israel are being led by the new leader Joshua after Moses has passed, and they are on their way to the promised land, to Canaan's land. And they are conquering. Not only are they defeating their enemies, they are decimating them. From Jericho and also the city of Ai, they have destroyed these cities and left carnage in their wake. They are on their way and they are undefeated, of course, because they have God on their side. And if God is with them, who can be against them? That is the backdrop of when this story takes place. This is the story of the Gibeonites and the deceit that they pull on the children of Israel. I'm going to read chapter 9 in its entirety. Bear with me. And then I'm just going to offer a few points after the reading. So beginning in Joshua chapter 9. Now it came about when all the kings who were beyond the Jordan, in the hill country and in the lowland, and on all the coast of the great sea toward Lebanon, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, heard of it, and they gathered themselves together with one accord to fight with Joshua and Israel. All these nations are ready to fight. But when the inhabitants of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to both Jericho and Ai, they also acted craftily and set out as envoys and took worn-out sacks on their donkeys and wineskins, worn out and torn and mended, and worn out and patched sandals on their feet, and worn out clothes on themselves. And all the bread of their provisions were dry and had become crumbled. Then they went to Joshua to the camp at Gilgal, and said to him and to the men of Israel, "We have come here from a far country. Now therefore make a covenant with us." The men of Israel said to the Hivites, "Perhaps you are living within our land. How then shall we make a covenant with you?" But they said to Joshua, "We are your servants." Then Joshua said to them, "Who are you, and where do you come from?" Then they said to him, "Your servants have come from a very far country because of the fame of the Lord your God, for we have heard the report of him and all that he did in Egypt and all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites who were beyond the Jordan, to Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who was at Ashtaroth. So our elders and all the inhabitants of our country spoke to us, saying, 'Take provisions in your hand for the journey, and go to meet them, and say to them, "We are your servants. Now then, make a covenant with us. This, our bread, was warm when we took it for our provisions out of our houses on the day that we left to come to you. But now, behold, it is dry and has become crumbled. These wineskins which were filled were new, and behold, they are torn. And these are clothes, and our sandals are worn out because of the very long journey." So the men of Israel took some of their provisions and did not ask for the counsel of the Lord. Joshua made peace with them, and he made a covenant with them to let them live. And the leaders of the congregation swore an oath to them. So it came about at the end of 3 days after they had made this covenant with them, that they heard that they were neighbors and that they were living within their land. Then the sons of Israel set out and came to their cities on the third day. Now their cities were Gibeon and Chapira and Beeroth and Kirath-Jearim. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the congregation, "We have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, so that wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them." The leaders said to them, "Let them live." So they became hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation, just as the leaders had spoken to them. Then Joshua called for them and spoke to them, saying, "Why have you deceived us, saying, 'We are very far from you,' when you are living within our land? Now therefore you are cursed, and you shall never cease being slaves, both hewers of wood and drawers of water for the house of my God." So they answered Joshua and said, "Because it was certainly told your servants that the Lord your God had commanded his servant Moses to give you all the land and to destroy all the inhabitants of the land before you. Therefore we feared greatly for our lives because of you and have done this thing. Now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us." Then he did to them and delivered them from the hands of the sons of Israel, and they did not kill them. But Joshua made them that day hewers of wood and drawers of water for the congregation and for the altar of the Lord to this day in the place which he would choose. So there you go. You have a nation that is living within the borders of Canaan, and they are looking around and they are seeing the many victories that Israel is having, and they decide, if we don't do something, if we don't act out of desperation, we're going to end up like one of them. And so they do this evil, deceitful, guileful thing. But in doing so, they have their lives spared. A lot is made of Rahab hiding the spies and this big morality question regarding it. She hid the spies and she lied about hiding the spies, and yet she saved their lives, and she is found in what is called the Hall of Faith or Heroes of Faith. She is listed as somebody as having great faith despite doing something that God seems to be opposed to. It's quite the conundrum to think about. And I think this is a similar thing, of which there are no easy answers. It was, of course, wrong for the Gibeonites to do this thing, to be deceitful, to lie. But in doing so, their lives were saved, and they were sworn into allegiance following the children of God. So what the Gibeonites did was they wore old clothes, got old food, old dirty provisions, and they came to the Israelites and pretended that they were from far away. And so they appealed to the Israelites, and for the Israelites, this made a lot of sense. If these people were actually outside of their borders, well, they would need to secure their borders. So at some point along the way, it would make sense to start making covenants and contracts with the outlying cities. That way, their promised land could be secure. From a diplomatic point of view, this made perfect sense. The Gibeonites also do something very clever, albeit deceitful, is that they begin to stroke the ego of the Israelites. Verses 9 and 10 says that we've heard of you. My version says fame. You have achieved fame for what you have done. You going in and destroying these cities, we're in awe of you. That's the kind of people we want to serve. Kind of propping them up. And it looks like it worked. So the Gibeonites, they schemed and they were successful in deceiving the children of Israel. But something to glean from this is the fact that the Gibeonites realized something very important, that there was no way to beat God. There was no way to beat someone with God on their side. They were going up against a force that they could not win against. It was an unwinnable battle. And they realized that. Other nations were not smart enough to realize the same thing. At the beginning of the chapter, there is a list of all those nations that are in the land that the Israelites are going to take. And what are they deciding to do? They're saying, well, they're coming, so we better fight. We better take up arms, we better hunker down, and we better get ready for the fight of our lives. Even though Israel had already decimated cities, they didn't seem to get the point that they would just become another number on that list of cities overtaken by Israel. It's important to note that the Gibeonites were not swayed by this herd mentality. They didn't go along with how everybody else viewed the Israelites. They didn't believe that the majority would prevail. It's possible that these other cities had more troops, had more advanced armor and weapons than the Israelites did. They were looking at it from a sheer military, strategic point of view, saying, of course we can take them. They're outnumbered. We have better equipment. We have a stronghold here. Of course, that didn't matter to Jericho, and it wouldn't matter to any of these other cities, because it doesn't matter how few people the Israelites had. God was on their side, and when God was with them, nobody could be against them. The Gibeonites seemed to be the only ones that took that into account. And verses 9 and 10 tells us that they recognized that there was a God on their side, and that the power that they were deriving from that God would be enough to destroy them. There's this idea in the modern world that God kind of belongs to everybody. God is for everybody. Every religion gets to have their own version of God. You see these bumper stickers, very preachy bumper stickers that say coexist, and it has all the different emblems of religions on it. And the idea behind this bumper sticker is kind of like, can't we all just get along? Can't we put aside our own individual views of God and acknowledge that other people can have God as well? Can't we share God, is basically what it's saying. Now, that's not to say that other religions or other people don't have the same freedom of religion that we have and that they can't believe what they do believe. But this idea that we are supposed to concede that all other religions have validity, that every religion has the same amount of validity, is absurd. Because the religions themselves don't concede that to other religions. Those of other faiths, of other viewpoints, who believe in a God other than ours, do not believe that our religion has the same validity they have. So it's very unreasonable to bind that on other people. We know of the God we are serving. We are sure of that. We know that there is one God, one true God, and as Christians we seek him out, and he is the one that we worship. This is something the Gibeonites also realized. They realized there is only one true God. In a time of paganism, in a time of idol worship, they said, there is one God, and we need to seek him out and figure out how to be on his side. They didn't believe in everyone else's God. They believed in Israel's God, capital G. So, the Gibeonites, as a consequence for their cunning and their guile and their deceit, they became servants, and in doing so, they gained life. They were willing to give up their freedom, which is something that nowadays not everybody will do. Many people do not come to religion, do not come to God through Jesus for this very reason. They don't want to give up their freedom. They are not willing. And some who do come to religion come from a point of bargaining. They come to say, all right, I'll be a part of your church, but what can you do for me? How can you make me feel? Rick Warren, very famously, when he was founding his church, a man who's found a lot of success in the secular world with his church and his viewpoint of religion, when he was starting up, basically what he did was he went door to door and said, I'm starting the church. What's it going to take to get you in the door? What do I got to get for you to get you there? And apparently, that's a tactic that worked, because he came to it from a bargaining perspective. People believe that God is something to be bargained with at some points. The Bible makes it very clear that is far from the case. God is not here to bargain with us. He is here to accept our unconditional surrender. He is here to make servants of us. And in doing so, we lose freedom, we lose liberty, but boy do we gain life. The Gibeonites realized that this was no time to be selfish. This was no time to hang on to the freedom and the life that they had, that they were comfortable with. Because if they didn't act, they would lose that life. We have nothing if we stand against God. Verse 8, they position themselves as their servants. They come humbly and they say, we are your servants. They were under no illusions under what circumstances that they would have to be serving the Israelites. Take close notice of verse 25. The Gibeonites, I'll go ahead and read it again. Verse 25, now behold, we are in your hands. Do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. Take note of what they say there. Do to us. Not for us, to us. Right there, therein lies the problem that a lot of people have with their relationship in Christ. They are wanting to know what God will do for them, not what God will do to them. When we are entering into this covenant with Christ through baptism, we are saying this very thing that the Gibeonites are saying, essentially. We are in your hands, do as it seems good and right in your sight to do to us. And a lot of things are done to us in our walk as Christians. Not all positive. Sometimes things are done to us by others that are very hard to deal with. Sometimes we don't have answers for the things that are done to us. But we are in God's hands. And as long as we are, we will be delivered. We are not here to bargain with the Lord. We are here to serve the Lord. Now, it's important to note that the Gibeonites, when they were becoming servants, this was a form of slavery. There were no benefits serving the Israelites. This wasn't something where they were getting days off or vacation time. They were entering into slavery, clear and simple. They were going to be subjected to a life of very hard labor, strenuous. They were hewers of wood and drawers of water for the whole congregation. For all of Israel, they were in charge of supplying water, cutting down trees for building materials. This was hard labor. They knew that that is what they were looking at. And that is the consequence for the sin that they committed against the children of Israel. And they were willing to accept the consequences. This reminds me a lot of another story that we read in the Bible, and that's the parable of the rich young ruler. The rich young ruler is the man who kept his freedom, kept his life, decided that he was going to live the way he wanted, to keep his wealth and live with his wealth, spending it any way he desired. And he had the world, he gained the world, but he lost his soul. And what does it profit a man to gain the world but lose his soul, as the scriptures say? So something to think about. Would you rather be in the place of the Gibeonites or the rich young ruler, where you are subjecting yourself to a hard life, one of servitude, one of labor, but in the end you are on the right side, you are in the hands of God? Or would you rather live a free life among your wealth and your possessions, in the end to lose it all because you have forfeited your soul? Something to think about. Another thing to think about is that the Israelites were not entirely innocent in this as well. The Israelites had made a very, very grave error regarding this whole situation. And the chapter tells us that they did not consult God. At no point during this did they think that maybe it would be a good idea if we see what the Lord has to say about this. If they did, no doubt they would be saved a lot of grief, as I'll go into a little bit towards the end of the lesson. But they would have received the wisdom of God in dealing with this situation, and perhaps things would have turned out better for both parties, or at least for Israel. But they did not. They decided that this was something they could handle without the wisdom of God, a mistake perhaps we ourselves make. Too many times, too often, are we confronted with a situation or something that we think we can handle, and we get pretty far into it. I'm speaking from my own personal experience. So many things that I'm dealing with in my life, and sometimes it's days into it before I realize that I haven't even prayed to God about this. I haven't even sought God's counsel in this situation. Something to think about. So the Israelites were not innocent in this situation either. Something the leaders also didn't do was consult the people. The leaders apparently decided amongst themselves, without God or without any outside opinion, what the best scenario would be, what they should do going forward. And as a result, the people grumbled against them. The people were upset, perhaps rightly so, that their leaders had made such a spur-of-the-moment decision, such an uninformed decision, and it was going to cost them greatly. The leaders did not seek wisdom from others. Sometimes we don't talk to our own brothers and sisters in Christ about what we are enduring. Sometimes, even if we take it to the Lord in prayer, we do not allow the avenue of fellowship to factor into it. God gives us prayer as one of the tools we can use to deal with hardship. But he also gives us each other. And one of the reasons it is so important that we have fellowship is that we come every Lord's Day and be with each other is so that we edify each other and let each other know that we are here no matter what. We are here for each other. We need to confide. As the scriptures say, confess your sins to one another, for we all have sin. Nobody is without sin. We are here for each other to be utilized. We are a gift from God to each other. So, God was not consulted, the people were not consulted. And as such, a lot of faith was probably lost in these leaders of Israel for their shoddy leadership. The Psalms say that a man swears to his own hurt and changes not, which is a way of saying that the truth hurts, but a man who is of the truth will speak it, regardless of how painful it is. When we are of the truth, we are to speak it regardless of the consequences. We cannot shy away from it. And now that Israel was locked into this oath, they had to deal with it. They had to deal with the consequences of their own ignorance, of their own mistake. And that consequence is a pretty big one. They promised that they would not kill these people, even if the promise was made on a false premise, being that they thought these people were from outside their lands. They still had to deal with the fact that they had a promise they had to keep. So, they couldn't kill these people. They could not touch them. They had an obligation to fulfill. A lot of people nowadays are looking for a way out, especially among my generation, or maybe a little older than me. I think I'm what's technically considered Generation Z. There's another group of people called the millennials nowadays. These are the Facebook generation or the smartphone generation. A lot of people, especially this seems to be the stereotype, is that they're looking for a way out. You hear a lot about student debt or credit card debt and how a lot of people, presidential candidates, are promising ways to make it all go away. All these things that they have incurred upon themselves. They chose to go to college. They chose to spend all that money in pursuit of a higher education. They chose to spend with money that they did not have in some of these cases. And so, yes, many people are in debt in one way or another. And a lot of these people who are trying to lead the country are appealing to these people by saying, you don't have to honor that debt. If you elect me, we will figure out a way to make it all go away, where you can have everything for free and not have to worry about the consequences. If you are a child of God, this mentality should frighten you. That is not the way that we are expected to live our lives. when we take on a debt, we are to repay that debt. We are not to look for a way out. And yet, this is what many do. The Israelites perhaps wanted a way out, but they realized that they had taken on a debt that they now owed these people, and they were going to have to uphold that. The next chapter of Joshua, which you can read on your own time as a continuation of the story, talks about the price that they would have to pay for protecting these people and granting them the freedoms and the protections that the Israelites had themselves. Chapter 10, they are going to have to go into battle as a direct result of the Gibeonites. So it's pretty immediate, the consequences. They're already going to have to go into battle, and they are going to lose their own. They are going to lose souls, members of their people, due to the fact that they promised foreigners what they shouldn't have. That is just the immediate cost. The cost of this agreement was far-ranging and went on for some time. In 2 Samuel, we read the story of David surrendering the sons of Saul to execution. Why? Well, it's because the sons of Saul violated this very agreement right here, made in Joshua chapter 9. All the way in 2 Samuel, we're talking hundreds of years down the road, this agreement, this covenant made before God was still standing. That is how important it is to God that we keep our promises. The fact that this thing still had consequences for disregarding it all the way down the road. Men lost their lives. David delivered the sons of Saul to execution because they broke a covenant. It was hundreds of years old, but it was a covenant of God, and those are timeless. When we enter into salvation through baptism, that is a covenant. We are in it for life. Marriage is a covenant. There is no way out, regardless of time. We need to take our obligations, especially the ones made in the presence of Christ, seriously. So, you have irony, you have a bit of irony here, that you have deceit and deception on one hand, and you have honor and integrity on the part of the Israelites, and it ends up costing them. They have to protect the ones who deceive them. So, yes, the Gibeonites did a bad thing. They lied and they cheated to get themselves in a position where they were safe. And the Israelites did a bad thing. They did not seek God's help when they should have, and it cost them greatly. I'm not arguing that either of the parties are justified by the actions that they took here in chapter 9. But the application I want to make is that what if God asked of you the same thing that the Gibeonites were given? What if God says, you are going to be my servant. You are going to spend your life drawing water and hewing wood for the whole congregation. This is going to be your end. This is what you will spend your life doing, serving me. Would we do it? Because that's essentially what we are doing, maybe not in a physical sense. What bothers me and should bother many Christians is this idea that many have of the Lord's Prayer and faith alone being enough to save someone. Not just because it discounts the very important aspect of baptism, which is repeated for us by example throughout the New Testament, but because these people have this idea that if you just believe, if you just have faith, if you just say these words, you will be saved. There is no just when it comes to salvation. Jesus doesn't say, just take up your cross and follow me. He says, take up your cross and follow me. A cross. When we should picture Jesus carrying his own cross to his crucifixion. It is weighty. It is heavy. He stumbles under the burden of it. And that is the same burden that we take on when we agree to be children of Christ. There is no just about it. It is a hard thing to do. We are hewing wood and drawing water. We are sacrificing our freedoms and our liberties and the things that we want to do in life for the things we need to do in life. And that is the application I want to make today. Jesus says, take up your cross and follow me. He doesn't say it's going to be easy, but it's something we must do. And when we do it, we are going to be rewarded greatly for it. There are many rewards that come from being a child of God in this life, but we know that the ultimate reward awaits us in the next one. So, if there is anybody in the congregation today who knows that it is time for them to take up their cross and follow Christ, no matter what the consequences, or perhaps you are one who has not treated the covenant that you made with Christ with the honor it deserves, and you want help with that, in getting back into the right with that covenant, whatever it is we can do to help you this morning, come forward as together we stand and as we sing.